頑張ります
That's exactly what we're trying to avoid. We bought a special machine.
All we have to do is get it from Rabbi Rosenman.
I'm trying to tell you, I bought a special machine.
We're playing machine first.
All right, Rabbi Bosa, if you could please take your seats, we'd like to begin immediately. Thank you.
Damn it. Damn machine.
Where's the plug is in there?
Ago we were at Einstein, and one of the presentations.
Dealt with what is intensive care, and Dr. Harold Adell at that time spoke about the interferences with the normal lifestyle of a patient, where the constant monitoring of the patient produced burnout on the part of many nurses very early in their career and others, and therefore there's a high price you had to pay for technological advances. Perhaps your observation of the procedures here to tape these proceedings this morning would indicate what happens even under normal circumstances, where supposedly the health of the person being observed is at least somewhat within the normal range. We're pleased that you could join us this morning, members of the Rabbinic Alumni, faculty, guests, and students. So this program, sponsored by the Jewish Medical Ethics Consultation Service at REITS, is an innovative one in several respects. Firstly, and I wish to express our gratitude to the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, particularly to its dean, Dr. Dominic Perpera, who made available the facilities of Einstein to members of the halachic community, the Rosh Yeshiva of REITS, and members of the alumni. And on December 8th, we had a series of sessions and demonstrations by the members of the faculty dealing with the brain and its functions, neurological basis for the definition of brain death, an extensive presentation on intensive care, and an exploration of the legal questions involved in brain death. The purpose of the first session was to provide the base so that in consideration of halachic issues, we would have the current thinking on the medical advances as well as the care aspects of patients who unfortunately are in a state where their recovery is in great question. Today, what we will attempt to do is to explore from a halachic perspective those issues which impinge directly on the definition of death and the specific implication for transplants. Now, certainly, the advances in medical education and in technological areas have presented opportunities to enhance the quality of life and also challenges to the sanctity of life. There are medical, legal, halachic definitions of death, and there are moral implications for the accepting of organs taken prior to the halachic determination of the moment of death. The medical ethics program at Yeshiva, which is initiated by Rabbi Tendler, and today Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Schachter are the senior consultants to this process, also involves members of the rabbinic alumni who have been responding to questions from the rabbinic community and the community at large, seeking direction on questions of life and death which they face daily. It is the purpose of this consultation service not to offer hotline quickie responses to serious questions, but rather to explore with a knowledgeable, interested, and caring caller what steps ought to be taken to familiarize oneself with the complexities of the issue and then to go to rabbinic authorities that are competent to deal with these questions. The Einstein conference was part one. Today is part two. I would like to give you just a brief outline of today's schedule and the procedures that we will follow. Rabbi Tendler, who is the chairman of the Department of Biology and a senior Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, who is well known for his writings and consultations in medical areas, will present first for approximately 1 hour, and then there will be questions and answers for a period of 15 minutes. This will be followed by the presentation of Rav Schachter, who is Rosh Kolel and also leading POSEG within our community. We'll have an opportunity to present for approximately an hour, and then we will allow for a half hour of questions and answers to be followed by any respondents or the members of the panel to each other. We would ask that the questions be questions to the point, and an adequate opportunity will be provided for questions to be presented. Certainly we will not be able to cover in depth all of the issues that are on people's minds, but we do hope to, through this program, to advance the education, halakhic education, as well as greater sensitivity to the ramifications of what will be presented today. It is my pleasure to call upon Rav Moshe Tendler.
Thank you, Rav Hertz. There's a special purpose to this program that Rav Hertz didn't underscore, but I'm sure he's fully aware of. And that is the emphasis on teaching Torah to our Talmidim. In doing so, it's important when issues of halacha become the discussion of the public domain, that a Talmid in the yeshiva should avoid what is properly referred to in academic circles as the Williams syndrome, to show that you are learned when someone quotes something from Shakespeare, you say, "Oh yes, William." There should be greater familiarity with topics so critical to the moral fabric of our society as the determination of death, and most significantly, the message that we deliver to the world at large is that our Torah does not change because it needs no change, because it is ever responsive, ever current, can only be emphasized by a knowledge and an ability to be articulate in these great social issues. As I deliver my paper, my shiur, Rav Schachter, likewise, I'm sure many questions will arise. I suggest that you note them on a piece of paper It'll be easier to take them all at the end. Also, it's better academic discipline to do so. However, so that you don't have too much inner tension, I'd like to flash on the board the outline of what I'm going to present to you, so that if there's a question that arises in your mind and it's going to be discussed later, you can listen with greater ease, not being confused by the personal ego to try to disprove what I'm saying. If you just feed it, unfortunately our back to you, I'm sorry. I think you're the other secret. I don't know. Not my secrets. I've heard mention the fact that we had a prior session. Many of you, or most of you, did not attend that session. And I will try to impress you by how much I learned at that session and summarize the biological facts upon which the halacha depends. We'll run through first the biological facts, anatomical and physiological, discuss the changing nature of scientific truths, present to you what is the current status of cardiac transplants, since so much has happened in the field of medicine, so that the repetitive use of such expressions as found in my own early writings and in the tshuvas of my Shreel Zatzal and Igros Moshe about double murder, that it doesn't work anyway, obviously was referring to a period of time that was long before 1988, a period of time in which medical world was also dismayed by the paucity of good results and declared a moratorium on cardiac transplants. The testing protocol, how we actually determine when a patient is brain dead, and then in outline number two, the halachic sources upon which we determine that indeed the testing program presently used is in full accord with the halacha, apnea, referring to the inability to breathe, a loss of breathing ability, the halachic sources for that, the concept that a term which I introduced into the field, physiological decapitation, the concept of brain dead without being brain severed, and then what has become in the halachic community a most disturbing aspect, and that is the name-dropping technique of Paskin and Shilas, of quoting and misquoting the actual sources from the writings of Rabbi Feinstein Zatzal, flashing them on the board for you so you can see it with your eyes, in the hope that osios machtimos, that seeing the words themselves will make you wise enough to be able to differentiate truth from falsehood. And the third part, a direct response to the areas of confusion as they exist today in the literature. Many have written analyses that question the validity of brain death criteria as acceptable to halacha. I found in the literature these 8 points, which I will summarize. They will all have been covered in the initial presentation, and we'll summarize them so that they can stand out clearly for your attention. Mark, if you, I'm sorry, Mishtamish with Talmud Chacham is not supposed to be proper, but such a Talmud Chacham you're not yet. Let me begin by a most primitive diagram. Just move it on a little bit so that you can see the back. This is taken actually from the volume that was published by the President's Commission on Brain Death, which led to the Uniform Determination of Death, Uniform Determination of Death Act, which has become the federal law and has been accepted de facto in every state of the Union, de jure in some 38 states, excluding New York State, where the opposition of Agudas Yisrael and the Catholic Church, strange bedfellows, have not allowed the passage of this law. Nevertheless, it is legal, it is law, by case law. By that I mean the appellate division, in a famous case in which a defense attorney for a murderer claimed that the death of the victim had not occurred through the attack of the murderer, but rather through the actions of a transplant team that removed the heart and lungs after the patient had been declared brain dead by the medical staff. That defense was not accepted. The declaration was made that brain death, as determined by the medical community, is legal death, and hence it is, they say, case law. Nevertheless, there is still a great, great vacuum left in the legal structure because of the absence of legislation. In the absence of legislation, it'll still go to trial, and you can threaten a doctor with the discomfiture of having to defend himself in a court action. This is proved to be a deterrent in having doctors involved in requesting organs for organ transplantation. Therefore, there's still a great need to finish off the story here in New York State so that we can have a brain death legislation passed finally after some 18 years of trying. We are referring to the following physiological state, a state in which the area known as the brainstem, which incorporates most significantly the breathing center, is devoid of any activity. That occurs when the blood supply to this area is interrupted. Obviously, if the blood supply is interrupted to the brain stem, it will not reach the top part of the brain. When the blood flow is not interrupted, you can have parts of the brain that are functional, and most significantly, the breathing center remains active. In the famous Karen Quinlan case, a case that has caused possibly the most confusion in the field, because in error, the neurologist in New Jersey referred to Karen Quinlan as brain dead, and then to the surprise of everybody, when they removed the respirator, expecting her to die, she did not. She lived on for years after that. But there was no basis for assuming that she was brain dead, for when this happens, it means that everything else above is dead, which means, as we'll point out, that all the Harvard criteria for signs, clinical signs of cerebral, cerebellar, medulla death has occurred. Everything is not functioning. This therefore means that in the course of time, and let me speak now of time, what we mean by time, in the course of minutes, the brain cells will begin to die. In the course of hours, these brain cells will reveal themselves as dying cells under a microscope. In the course of a day, 24 hours, if you open the skull, the brain will be liquefied. This is what we mean by physiological decapitation. There is a mechanical connection between this part and this part, but it's only a mechanical dead connection, and hence the term brain dead, as we'll define in a few moments, refers exactly to that condition, a condition in which the brain is devoid of any oxygen and hence undergoes noticeable morphological changes, which is referred to by the pathologist as a respirator brain. A pathologist can identify that without looking in a microscope by seeing the external color and texture of the brain, know that this brain has been devoid of oxygen or has suffered an anoxic episode long enough for it to be irreversible. The purpose of a nervous system is to integrate the organism. We have two systems that integrate an organism. The hormone system, the endocrine system, which tells other parts of the body what another part of the body is doing. And it also refers to the nervous system. My eye sees something, it'll tell my leg what to do. My leg is doing something, my mind knows it. Your ability to catch a ball, a miraculous ability, you see a ball leave a man's hand, you put your hand up and the ball somehow falls in your hand occasionally. That involves so much integration of muscles and nerves that can only occur because there is one system integrating it, a brain that is calculating distances, velocities, etc., that is a marvel even in our age of artificial intelligence. When this integrated system is broken, we now no longer have an organism. We now have an organ system. An organ system, by that I mean a system by which organs are kept alive. In a brain dead individual, the imagery I'm painting for you is, imagine that I took out the heart and kept that heart pumping. Something that has been done 40 years ago, 50 years ago by Dr. Carell. There's no problem keeping a human heart alive outside the body for months or years. Obviously, this heart has a beat of its own. It is marching to its own drummer. The liver, we cannot keep alive very long. The kidneys, we keep alive a little bit longer. The need to rush a transplant donor to the patient or rush his organ to the patient is really a measure of sensitivity to anoxia. Different organs, different cells respond differently to loss of oxygen. And here I'd like to introduce an exception to what we are discussing. We are only discussing brain death in an adult. We are not discussing brain death in children under the age of 2, and certainly not under the age of 2 months. There we have evidence to indicate that there is greater resistance to anoxia than in adults, and therefore all the rules that have been worked out for brain death apply only to adults. And children need new rules. Such rules have been now promulgated. They have not yet been widely accepted, but in practice there is no difficulty in determining brain death in children because of what I will make reference to, the blood flow study that I've been postulating as essential to establishing without doubt that brain death has occurred. This anoxia differential will explain why you can cut off the supply to your finger and your finger gets numb and doesn't fall off. But if you cut off your supply to your finger long enough, then the finger will fall off. When capillaries die, as in diabetics, they lose their toes, they lose their ankles, they lose their knees, because the blood supply cut off and gangrene sets in. Brain death is gangrene of the brain, nothing more than that, nothing less than that. Yet, brain cells, nervous cells, are so sensitive to anoxia, to the loss of oxygen, that according to the best evidence we have, keeping oxygen away from the brain for as little as 40 seconds will introduce irreversible changes. In practice, since the blood has oxygen in it, it takes a while before it uses up the available oxygen. But actual loss of oxygen is almost instantaneous death when it comes to a nerve cell. Not so for a muscle cell, not so for other cells, not so for blood cells even. The definition of brain death, as widely accepted now, is included in this legal definition of how you determine death. It is the President's Commission language, which has been modified a little bit in discussion with the AMA, etc., and finally came out to sound like this. An individual who has sustained either irreversible cessation of circulation or respiratory functions, which was the, quote, the old definition of death. Irreversible cessation of all function of the entire brain, including the brainstem, is dead. The determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. Now here, let me explain to you again. That first definition has no rules regulating it. A young medical student just out of medical school, the so-called July 1 intern, signs a death certificate based upon his decision that this patient is dead. The availability of legislation for the first time requires that this determination follow accepted medical practice, whatever that's supposed to mean. It's been my contention over the last few years that that should be spelled out in a law that would satisfy the laity under present conditions. The medical profession is highly resistant to anyone telling them how to run their business, and therefore they refuse to do more than put in accordance with accepted medical standards. Most physicians feel comfortable, most moral, ethical physicians, as most are, feel comfortable with that reservation because the lawyer who looks over their shoulder is available to check whether they did or did not live up to that requirement to be in accord with accepted medical standards. This definition, they say, is now almost universally accepted. It is, however, again, it requires a halakhic analysis as to exactly how we determine this, because how you determine this determines also certitude. And on this point, I'd like to make this clear statement. There has never been a single case. I'm talking about now cases involving the tens of thousands in which a patient who is declared brain dead by a competent neurologist in accord with, quote, accepted medical standards has shown any neurological recovery. In every case where they came to post, the brain showed the anatomical, morphological, cytological changes that occurs when a brain is devoid of oxygen. It is the only sure determination of death that we have today. Whenever we speak about circulatory and respiratory death, we mean brain death, nothing else. The Gemara refers to a condition known as nisalef. Rambam and Gimel of Ovel makes reference to it. You have to be careful before you bury someone. The chayshinan shema nisalef. Nisalef means respiratory, circulatory collapse that is still reversible because the brain has not been devoid of oxygen long enough for it to have undergone destruction. Until the brain is destroyed, circulatory and respiratory arrest can be corrected. You all read about it or have seen it yourself. A fellow stops breathing, you jump on him and make him breathe. A fellow's heart stops, you paddle his heart with electric shock back into life. That was not Tias HaMesim. You have not resurrected the dead. What you have done is administered to a living patient who is in serious medical difficulty, and you overcame the difficulty, no less than when a patient comes in with an arrhythmia, with a heartbeat that isn't going just well, and the doctor prescribes a pill, and the pill straightens out the rhythm. Here you had a major arrhythmia, it stopped completely, but nothing dramatic happened yet. The patient was treated quick enough for the correction to occur, namely for anoxia of the brain not to occur, and hence the circulatory respiratory collapse was only a transient, not a permanent state. Essentially, let me just thought I have a mark there on the side. It just raises up a little bit. This is the most important part, I guess. These guidelines, in turn, require clarification on two major points. If, as quoted, heart transplant is in the area of experimentation, not therapy, how does the heart transplant conform to Nuremberg Code, which demands that proper preparation be made for adequate facilities provided to protect the experimental subject against even remote possibilities of injury and spill of death? Secondly, it is not the proposal for an independent group of physicians, a self-indictment of the medical community. Since they do not trust each other, why should we put our trust in them? What's this got to do with what we're talking about? Just that the author of these words is myself, was written in tradition in spring 1968 after the Barnard did his first transplant, in which I was the first to come out, first that received public attention. The New York Times quoted me, I think the only opposition ever been was reported in the first few years, as saying that cardiac transplant as being performed was double murder. That was 1968. I'm convinced in 1988 that anyone who can provide a heart of a brain dead patient to save another one's life has in his credit the greatest mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, and those who interfere with that activity are guilty of shvichas dam, of causing the death of an innocent patient. What I'm emphasizing is the scientific fact versus the ultimate truth of Torah. Scientific facts are time bound. Mortal man is a time bound organism. What we knew in 1968 demanded this response. What we know in 1988 demands the statement I just made to you. It's therefore particularly disturbing, as we'll see when we come to the halachic sources, that people in 1988 are quoting tshuvas of 1968 or 1868 or 1678 in order to analyze the halachic position on brain death. It is a denial of Kadosh Baruch Hu Sheshalit Ba'olamo. Is the desire of Kadosh Baruch Hu, who rules his world and gave us the power to peel off the veils of ignorance that have clouded our faces so that we didn't understand nature. To deny that is to relegate Torah to medieval Jewish law instead of the Torah's Chaim, the living Torah that it is. Put together a collage. The current status of vital organ transplant. Now just quickly, you realize that today we transplant many organs besides the non-vital ones, such as a kidney, which a live donor is possible. We have vital organs, liver, lung, and heart. Until recently, it had to be heart and lung together. Now we can transplant lung independently. Liver, heart, and lung are vital organ transplants. You cannot take it from a living donor. You must take it only from a brain dead patient. And here, if you watch my words, this is one of the key psychological problems in discussing this whole area. I said to you, you cannot take it. You cannot take it from a living donor. You can only take it from a brain dead patient. A brain dead patient is a dead patient, not a brain dead patient. You can only take it from a dead patient who died recently. If you could get a patient who suffers circulatory respiratory collapse and watch him until his brain dies and then take it away, you have to watch him until his brain dies. I can't look at his brain. I give him time to paddle him back to life. Maybe he's not dead. I have to give him time to see where I can get him to breathe again, give some artificial respiration. That's the time period that the brain dies. If then immediately you will go ahead and do the surgery and remove his vital organs, that is a good donor. The reason you need a brain dead patient, you need a dead patient. But brain dead patients enable us to do the transplant before the organ suffers damage. We mentioned that the cells of the body have different sensitivities to anoxia, to loss of oxygen. The time you have, the so-called window during which you can transplant, depends upon the anoxia sensitivity of the organ you're dealing with. The kidney isn't so sensitive, so I have hours. The liver is more sensitive, I have only an hour or two. I don't even that much. The heart is not sensitive to the anoxia when compared to the brain, but it's very sensitive when compared to the problem at hand. A length of time to remove the heart, to put into another patient, the heart will not make it. It is too sensitive to the loss of oxygen to be able to wait until a patient has died, the heart has stopped, and then we use him. Therefore, when we determine that a brain dead patient exists, what we're essentially saying is, I have a new system. I've taken out the heart, put it into a special bucket where I can feed it oxygen and glucose and keep it in good shape for a few hours until I need it. I can't do that easily. So what I let happen, I let Kadosh Baruch Hu do it. Kadosh Baruch Hu provided the nutrient solution. It's called blood. Kadosh Baruch Hu provided a pump. It's called the heart. And the heart pumps itself and puts the blood back in. It has lungs to pump in oxygen, but the lungs could have been someone else's lungs, because if this patient is looked upon as dead, the lungs now become nothing more than a little compression pump that pumps oxygen like you do in a heart-lung machine, where you take the patient off his own heart and off his own lungs and allow the machine to provide oxygen and circulate the blood while the heart is being operated on. What's the current status? From 1968, it was double murder, and it was double murder. No patient who received the heart lived, and unfortunately, all the early patients were not brain dead. They were patients in deep coma who suffered massive brain damage, but had not met the criteria today that we know to be, namely, that the brainstem had died. That's why Barnard was not looked upon favorably in the medical community, or as many people believe, it could never have occurred except in a country where apartheid allowed a black man to be the donor for a white man. Today, and this data is December 1, 1987, a year from now, there are 4,000 in the U.S. now live with others' hearts. As of best data I was able to get from the American Heart Association last Thursday, there are now 4,600 patients who are alive today, more than 2 years, with someone else's heart. But watch what's important, the timing. I say we are a time-bound organism. 1967 was the first heart transplant. In 1968, Shumway at Stanford let people know that he was doing better. They put a moratorium, everybody stopped except Shumway. He then was able to convince the world that he knows how to do it. Everyone followed his techniques, and heart became what? It became a therapeutic procedure because of, look what had to happen. They had to be able to develop a mechanism to find out whether the heart was being rejected so that we could load up the patient with immunosuppressive drugs. And every patient today who has a heart, had a heart transplant, we have in our own community a young woman, every 6 months she goes back to Pittsburgh, they make a little cut in her neck, slip a wire down into her heart, rip out a little piece of the heart, examine under the microscope, so that they can check whether there are early signs of rejection coming in. If yes, they'll raise her immunosuppressive drugs. Because immunosuppressive drugs are not good for arichas yomim. They don't lead to longevity. They themselves are toxic agents. And you don't want to give too much of them. So when the patient is behaving, you keep his dose low. When the rejection activity builds up, you raise the level of the immunosuppressive drugs, specifically cyclosporin, the steroids, and the alkylating agents that repress the immune system. Those same drugs, by the way, or many of those drugs, are used in treating cancer patients. So you realize these are extremely toxic drugs, and that's why cancer patients suffer from loss of white blood cells, red blood cells. This immunosuppression also involves hematopoietic suppression of the blood forming mechanisms, and therefore you can't let a patient be on high doses for long periods of time. Without this, we would have kept on losing patients to the rejection problem. They were able to work out a system just as airplanes used to transport, not airplanes used to transport, they also developed different fluids in which to keep the heart, different simple little technological improvements that added an hour or two to the anoxia sensitivity of the heart so that now it could be transported to more distant places. In 1983, a miracle happened. An antibiotic that was on the shelf that had no value as an antibiotic was suddenly found to be extremely useful as an immunosuppressive drug. And cyclosporin is the cause of this great growth of transplant surgery. The large number of patients, the great successes, are largely due to the cyclosporin that allowed the patient to be kept immunosuppressed without him suffering the terrible infections that other patients previously suffered. When you immunosuppress a patient, he shouldn't reject the heart or the liver. You also immunosuppress him, he can't fight a strep, a staphylococcus, he can't fight a cold, etc. And it subjects the patient to all the invaders that normally he could handle. Once cyclosporin was used, we could drop the others, and therefore the patient maintained a good portion of his immunity intact. In 1985, the mechanical heart, the movement down the scale to infants, to show you can even transplant an infant heart. And 1987, just a record, a patient who was transplanted 8.5 years ago, who somehow the doctors made all the errors that canceled each other out, and the patient survived their best efforts, and he was able to live for 18.5 years. And if you read his story, 18.5 years, if you read his story, he was afraid that he didn't know how long the heart would last, so he lived the life of a Frenchman. Made sure he lived it to a hilt, slept 3 hours a night, was in every nightclub in the world, gambled all night, etc. Imagine what would be if he would have been a good Orthodox Jew who took off at least on Shabbos. He most likely would have lived to 120. All right, if I can have the next slide, next. This is a vintage reprint. It's August 6th, if you can bring that up, 1968, I believe. Right, 1968. This is the original Harvard criteria. Now here, let me just quickly bring you up to date. The Harvard criteria, which today is still the very best method of determining that a patient has died by clinical means, without any fancy equipment. This Harvard criteria is now being attacked by most neurologists as being too many chumras. It is too demanding. It's not necessary. We're smarter already. We don't have to go through all those steps to determine that a patient has indeed suffered brain death. But it will help you, I think, understand exactly what you mean by a brain dead patient. Just move it up. The first and most important thing is unreceptivity and unresponsivity. It means what a Hever Kadisha man would say, he died. You walk, you know, he's a man who lies there, he looks like he died. You stick him with a needle, he doesn't wince. You tell him that there's a man who wants to give him money, he doesn't stand up. There are ways you test this individual. He is not communicable. You cannot communicate with him. He doesn't communicate with you. He is unresponsive. Even the most intensely painful stimuli evoke no vocal or other response, not even a groan, withdrawal of a limb or quickening of a respiration, etc. There's no movement or breathing. Now, no movement means no movement. Karen Quinlan twisted and turned in bed when she was on the respirator. That we know cannot be a patient who has suffered total cessation of all brain function. The problem has been always in medicine, the slippery slope. She wasn't brain dead, she was almost brain dead. And the allowing yourself to nibble away at these definitions, of course, will ultimately lead to terror in the laity that indeed the transplant team will grab the heart before you're prepared to give it up. But that is not a reality. The reality, whether it came about because of concern for legal action, whether it came about because the doctors themselves realized, unless you hold the line sharp, the whole ethics of medicine can disappear. The fact is that we are very careful to define these terms now. A patient, no mood means no movement. there's total absence of spontaneous breathing. Now, how can you tell that when the patient's on a respirator? He couldn't breathe before. You slipped a tube down his mouth. The lungs are being inflated. That's what we meant. That's what we made reference to before, the apnea test, which I'll make reference to in a minute. If you move to the next one, these are the criteria. No reflexes. The classic neurological reflexes. We have Dr. Kielsen with us, a good chaver, Ben Teure, who is a neurologist at Maimonides, I believe the associate director of the Department of Neurology, who honors us by his presence. That's his bread and butter business. You do a neurological examination of a patient, you shine a light in his eyes, you pour ice water in his ears. There are certain responses that check whether the cranial nerves are functioning. If the cranial nerves are not functioning, the nerves going to the brain are no longer transmitting any message. We know there's a blockage way, way down there. And then comes the very questionable one that now people are attacking, the flat electroencephalogram, that the EEG should show no activity. The neurologists have been in dispute for many years whether this really is a significant finding or not. You can sometimes get activity in a bowl of jello, as they've shown, which has nothing to do with life or not life. Nevertheless, it's a good requirement and one that should be kept. And here goes the key. All of the above shall be repeated at least 24 hours later with no change. Which means if the patient was really was brain dead 24 hours ago, 24 hours later, that brain has life. In Metzius, we have no such condition where it's possible for brain death to occur and immediately to take out his heart, his lungs, his liver. They're always fit for nothing more than administrative purposes. There must be a lapse of hours before you can act on a patient. And therefore, in reality, we never determine a patient is dead on the basis of the brain dead criteria. We determine the patient had died 24 hours earlier or 48 hours earlier on the basis of the so-called brain dead criteria. In the field, writing this field of medical ethics, of halacha, saying things that are embarrassing to the Torah community. A Torah community who bothers to understand, as we discussed in our Torah Mada lecture, that Hashem Elohim made this world. There's a God of nature who's the same God who gave us the Torah. The question was posed in print, regrettably, as recently as 4 months ago or 5 months ago. Well, how about a patient on an iron lung? He cannot breathe, and if breathing is the critical aspect by which you determine whether a patient has died or not, that's the reason we depend so heavily on the apnea test, then a patient who suffered a polio or ate improperly canned food and suffered a botulinum attack, true food poisoning, and his phrenic nerve is paralyzed and cannot work his diaphragm, we put in a little iron lung and he breathes, and if it's a woman, she can get pregnant and have babies. That patient is dead because they cannot breathe independently. We are talking about a brain-dead patient, not a patient who can't breathe. A brain-dead patient can't breathe, but a patient who can't breathe is not brain-dead. If so, we would die, 16 or 18 times a minute. We don't breathe continuously. We breathe only sporadically. When a swimmer goes underwater, he does not die and then come up again, even though the Bali Musa treat Tzila B'mikveh that way. That is not what we mean by a brain-dead patient. A patient who's mooshing with the hands or yelling, "Help me, I can't breathe," is not a brain-dead patient. He's a patient who swallowed a hunk of steak and needs a Heimlich maneuver, not a burial. The idea that you could pose a question to relate brain-dead to a patient in respiratory collapse but in perfect physical state otherwise is a sign of either willful denial or just what's called nowadays in academic circles scientific illiteracy. Apnea testing is a very simple test. It's a standardized protocol. It's now accepted in every single hospital in the world. This is the way you determine whether a patient died or not. If the patient looks dead, doesn't move, meets the Harvard criteria, I still must make sure he's not breathing. That's required by law. You must do an apnea test. And the apnea test says that the patient can never breathe again, no matter what you do. That's the guarantee. The eye for that proves it. You load up the patient with oxygen. You saturate his blood with oxygen by giving him 100% oxygen. You do that for 30 minutes or an hour, depending which protocol you follow. You then turn off the respirator. If someone did it to you, you could stay underwater for 10 minutes that way. It would cause no difficulty because your brain cells have oxygen to live on from the heavy amount of oxygen in your blood. During that period of time, you watch the patient. You make sure that he has enough carbon dioxide in his blood to stimulate the breathing center. And if in that period of time, in that 10-minute period of time, he makes no effort to breathe, you know he cannot breathe. This satisfied the requirements that we were all concerned with. How can you test the patient by pulling out the respirator? If he's just on the verge of dying, if he's a real ghost, that stress may push him over, and how dare you do it to him? Therefore, in the tshuva we'll refer to later, Rabbi Feinstein Zatzal said, well, when you service the machine, you have to disconnect it anyway, then you can watch the patient. But nowadays, you don't have to disconnect the machine. The machines have changed. But there's no need to disconnect the machine to check whether the patient can breathe or not. You guarantee that you do not hurt the patient. There's no stress on the patient by first giving him the saturation with oxygen. That's what I'm referring to. The apnea test protocol employed proved to be safe and sensitive. Disconnection time from the ventilator 10 minutes in a patient of normal temperature, right? The pressure threshold of 60 milligrams of mercury should be reached in all patients. That guarantees that the patient, one, will not suffer from the test. There'll be no physiological stress on the patient because of the test. And in addition, you ascertain 100% the patient has lost the ability to breathe. You suspected that a long time ago, but you can back that up by another test, which I will make quick reference to later, by sum up this point by adding to it what we refer to as blood flow studies. And here too, somehow scientific illiteracy comes in. The criticism I've seen in literature is that how can you do a blood flow study? You stress the patient too much because it's a dangerous test. There are two kinds of blood flow studies that are done. Now in 1976, I wrote an article asking that blood flow studies be done, and I clearly referred to it as radioisotope bolus study. There are two tests. One you know about, called an angiogram. They put a tube up the veins into the brain area, inject dye, and then see in an x-ray whether the dye has gone into the blood vessels or not. Is there a blood flow to the brain, or where the blood flow has been interrupted? That's not what we are talking about. We are talking about a radioisotope study. You don't touch the patient. You don't make a hole in the patient. You can do it 10 feet from the patient if the pipe is long enough. He has an IV going into him. You inject into the IV a little radioisotope, the same isotope that people do routinely. They go in for heart testing, etc. You come back 10 minutes later with a portable camera. You don't touch the patient. Don't move the patient. You take a picture of the patient. And you see the whole circulatory system is lit up. And when it comes to the neck, you have what's called the hole in the head syndrome. The circulation reaches the skin around, and in the middle it's all black. No blood is reached, so the radioisotope has not exposed the film in that area. That's a test which you don't even touch the patient. There's no halach of gosis or saligabo. It is a 100% test. There's never been a case in which a blood flow study showed that the patient has suffered the cessation of blood flow where he has any restoration of neurological function. Which brings us to the second half of this of my presentation, and the second half of this Yom Iyun, the Yom Iyun Beis, the halachic points. And here in life will be easier. I believe mingle them together as it should be. Hafokbo, the Kuvibo, Torah included all the information I gave you up to now. It was no less Torah than what I'm telling you right now. The sources are obvious. And now you'll see how smart our Chazal were, as if they needed our approval. But watch what the wisdom of the sages is. The Mishnah is Arlos Perek Aleph. You're all familiar with that Mishnah. The key is what? Hutuzul Hashem if an animal or a man was beheaded, even though they still show muscular movement, if it's a man, it's betame biohel. If it's an animal, it's betame b'mago b'masa. Kigon hazonov shel halotor shehim mepacheses. No different than when you grab the tail of a lizard, and the lizard has the ability to say you want the tail so badly you can keep it, and the lizard runs away leaving the tail in your fingers, and the tail wiggles in your fingers. Is the tail alive or dead? The tail is dead. So is that individual whose head has been removed. That individual may be moving, but he is dead. Comes the Rambam, reads this up. It's a Perz Shai's Rambam, if you can catch it. Unbelievable language of the Rambam. Mitafatin Mitznoaim moves Vatunua Asher Yitosh Yomush Peivorim Abrahamovic. Yikro Tirkus, the movement of limbs after death of his Haltor, Hushem Asheres, right? And what's the. Then what? That Yisnana Znovo Meod Beyod Achatituko. Who people know, aware of that imagery, that if you ever try to catch lizards, even in America, in the mountains, you catch a lizard, he also leaves behind that the soil. The kids know it very well. They all walk around with handfuls of lizard tails. The Umdom. Yikorezel, Iksat, Mini, Barakayan. This happens to many different species. Kashalongia, Hakoa, Hamisnoa, Mispache, Bichlalhebor, and Mishorish, Asolahat. If there is no central source that directs movement, but you now have isolated sources of movement, what is the Rambam talking about? There's no central nervous system. You no longer have an integrative system. Sure, you have motion. Motion equals life, usually. But it's only when you have an integrative system. And since you've lost the integrative system, the fact that you have motion in a muscle, that's not life. Life is only when you have an organism, not when you have live organs that are beating, even when they are beating in synchronism with each other. The next one. The same is Gemara in Yuma. A house collapsed on an individual. Well, unfortunately, we can get new medical evidence from Armenia how long a person can lie under a pile of rubble. If it's on Shabbos, you don't want to be Mechal Shabbos for a dead man. You find that an individual under a pile of rubble. How do you check whether he's alive? He looks dead. Halech and Hubotek, what did I say? In Domelemes, he looks dead. I see him, he's not moving. I call him, he doesn't answer me. Chain of mazes evolve, he doesn't move any limbs. And Hekel and Mutaker, Matat, Emet. How much do you dig up before you're sure that he really did die? It's only at post mode. You only examine up to his nose. Why? Because everybody agrees. Abashol, Adolfo Modet. The ego kayuse the apehu. The essence of life is in the breath, the siv kalashanishma sua kayim biyako. That is the motto that says when a person cannot breathe spontaneously, he is dead. Not in an iron lung. Rashi was a word about someone who would be sufficiently insensitive to truth to be able to make such a mistake if you lower it. So Rashi warned, don't be such a big amoris. Remember, in domil lemes, he must first look dead. Shein ol meizu zevavav. Then we investigate. Adheikon hu mefakeach lodas emes. How much do you examine after that? But if you leave out the first part, obviously, a man who cannot breathe because he has a stone pressed against his chest and cannot heave his chest is not dead. He is pleading for you to remove the stone so he can live. Ne'ev esam shana. Next. What about the reference that we had before in the Mishnah Olos? There it says Hutaz Roshayim. The head is decapitated. And I introduced the term physiological decapitation. Who says it's the same? Maybe indeed, halachically, I need that mechanical, anatomical severance of the head from the body, as the Gemara declares, kemlika sa'ov, or not kemlika sa'ov. Do you have to remove the head completely from the body, or just break the brain connection to the body? When a kohen made melika on a bird, what he did was break the connection of the top of the brain to the bottom. We call that pithing. Students in general biology, unfortunately, have to do that to a frog in order to study the physiological behavior of muscles where the brain is not involved. You have a Gemara in Chulin. Gemara is a Chulin Daf Bava Aleph. And here too, I just need the Gemara over here. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Nishbura Machmekes Veroz Basarima, if his neck broke, what we call a quadriplegic ski accident, breaks his neck, Veroz Basarima, and there is major musculature injury, Mitame Ba'ohel, he is dead. He may be wiggling, moving, Halacha is dead, a kohen cannot be in contact with him. Can't be in the same tent with him, the same house with him. Vin Tomar Osa Mata di Eli. How about the story of Eli HaKohen? As it says by Eli HaKohen, Vayhi Katsiro Et Aron Elohim, when they mentioned to him that the Ark of the Lord was captured, by Yiko Me'alakise Ahonet, he fell backward off the chair, Vyadjar Hashar, Vatishbo Mafakto Vayomos, his neck broke and he died. And it doesn't say that there was any injury other than his neck broke. There's no mention about musculature tearing. And the Gemara, why? Because Kizoken Ish Kizoken Ish. Therefore, Zikno Shaini. An old man will die without the need to show great injury. The blow alone, even though the head is anatomically intact with the body, there is no severance of the head from the body, no outward injury at all. Nishbo mafakto, the connection is still there. And what means broke the neck? It means the nerve cord was severed. The blood vessels inside, being blood vessels of an old man, they are rigid, they are not longer flexible. Therefore, it is a physiological state. There you have a physiological state. The blood flow was interrupted to the brain, therefore he died. That true brain death. Eli suffered brain death. Brain death due to the severance or the interference of the blood vessels that lead to the brain. Give me the next one. And I'll stay within my time schedule. Introduction was too long. So. I have a rule that it's a factor of 20, an introduction. Okay? I looked for other sources to see whether this concept of physiological versus anatomical is recorded in the halacha. Indeed it is. In the halacha of Eva Menachai, I didn't bother with the Gemara, I brought you just the Yerodeya. They say Zohar Shanitlushu Vadai Hein Urim Vikisam Eina Oso Menatora. If the testicles were injured and they're still in the scrotum, they are not called Eva Menachai. Sharei, why? Yeshbo Mixatius, because they have yet some life in them. Latika, Eina Matsia, that's why there is no decay. But if there would be a sign of decay, it would show that there is no life in them, and they would be called Eva Menachai, and therefore would be also to make use of them. Therefore, you see, Chazal recognized not that because there's a greater injury, because they're ripped apart. The key test is, was the physiological connection broken? The tendons of the testicle that connect it would not be severed. And for it to be masir, all I need is for there to be enough torsion, enough twisting, so that the blood vessels established anoxia. The blood vessel didn't feed the blood. Anoxia of the testicle occurred. The testicle began to die. Once there's a sign of sirochon, the sign of the decay, you know that there is no longer a connection between that part and the rest of the body. You have here a case of physiological surgical removal. A physiological surgery, not an anatomical surgery. And the last one. It is the caption alone. I don't know if the Bechaba is the author of the caption, but whoever put the caption in is the Talmud Chacham anyway. Mishu Choshev Kemes Afati Shodeno Chai. How's that for language? Who is considered to be dead even though he's alive? What he's trying to warn you is he has Simoni Chiyus, but he's dead up to Yalotah. Mishu Nizbo Rabatakya Verol Vosrimo Hey Mishu Nikra Migava Kedog. The next one. Or die for the mesentime oil, right? Don't say to me, Shadish was no base in London, of two, how they ain't a metama chetating option. If, however, the jugulars, the esophagus and the trachea was cut, even though he's surely going to die, Nishlu base in London, nevertheless, he's dying. He's in a dying process. A dying process is not dead. When he's dead, he'll be metama oil, until he dies, not. And here too, unbelievable scientific illiteracy is expressed by the people who criticize the brain death criteria halakhically. So how could it be, if you say brain death is so critical, if Nishra too, both based among him, right? He cannot breathe. How can you consider him to be alive? Nishra too, based among him, doesn't mean he cannot breathe. You ever hear of a tracheotomy? I make a hole in the trachea to let him breathe. The fact that he has an injury to the esophagus doesn't mean he cannot breathe. This has nothing to do with breathing. This has to do with imminence of death. He's imminently dead because the injury, if he cuts through the trachea and the esophagus, there's no way that that individual is going to survive in those conditions. Nowadays, I'm pretty sure the surgeons could still get to him in time and do a fairly good job, a good percentage of restoring him to good health. This has the Shulchan Aruch contrasts nishba mafrakto, where you have a loss of ability to breathe, with imminence of death. It's not the same. We are not prepared to give up 1 second of a person's life, even though it's life where the clock is running down, even though he's dying. The diagnosis is 100% he's dying. He's entitled to all the protection of society until that very last second when indeed he does die. Which will now, I think, enable me to sum up quickly. But you have to see with your own eyes to be able to believe that this could possibly have been a source of confusion to anybody in the field, anybody knowledgeable in the field. The first tshuva my father-in-law wrote was in 1968. Make sure to put the date down so you understand. In 1968, no reputable doctor in America considered heart transplant other than double murder. Following this period of time in the early 70s, you remember, Harvard was threatened. The community council at Harvard at Cambridge threatened them to remove their tax exemption if they persist in doing heart transplants. Forced them to accept the moratorium. That's how sure we were that they were indeed committing double murder, or at least the murder of the recipients. Here, Israel wrote to Rav Weiss, now the Rav Bezdin of Yerushalayim. And he wrote to Rav Weiss, the scholars, I don't want to talk about this topic even. I believe that it's also to do so. Anyone who discusses it is only weakening the position of the halacha. It's also period. I need no proof for it. It's a bad thing to do, it's murder, you shouldn't do it, period. Here, by the way, skip me to number 10. Here, the end, this is the tshuva, the last tshuva in Yerodei Achelik Beis. The end of that tshuva is worthy, although it's not on our topic now, but it should come up in your questioning, so therefore I'm calling it to your attention. He was asked, how can you ask a family to sign that they're willing to give up the organs for transplant? There's a word out, the word is out in the field, an Orthodox Jew cannot be a donor. He can only be a recipient. You can take the organs, but you can't give it, which is not a very happy position to be in. It's called Chilul Hashem. The question was posed to him, you said, our wife had written him that surely you cannot require someone. It's a disgrace. You're desecrating the dead. that he had quoted already previously in the Shubit. Not only is it not a disgrace, of course, it's no such nonsense. There's no bazillion for someone's organ to be used to save someone else's life. And then he says, but you asked a good question, he says. You said that there is great pain. Really, there's no requirement for an individual to approve the organ donation, because we learn that a person suffers more anguish from seeing a dead body being incinerated, being degraded, being denigrated, more than loss of money. And since the Torah didn't require you more than to give up all your money to prevent an isur or to do a mitzvah, certainly he cannot require you to suffer the anguish of knowing that your signature caused the desecration of a loved one. He says, but therefore, he says, mitzvah vada'ika, but certainly it's a mitzvah to sign and allow the donation to occur. Even though these are part of nature to suffer from such things, establish a tear black out there. You don't understand the mitzvah. Those who know my Shrael's language, is always a little stilted language, but he has his way of getting his musar in. You say you're suffering anguish because they're cutting up a loved one. The mitzvah is not to have any anguish. The mitzvah is to recognize you're saving the life of somebody, and therefore there is no anguish in this whole process. And therefore it's a mitzvah to donate organs. This nonsense that's been perpetuated, the Orthodox community does not approve of organ donation. Nonsense. We don't approve of murder. Don't approve of taking the organ before the fellow is still using it. But we certainly believe that organ donation is a great mitzvah. Possibly the greatest kavod you can do to an individual is even after death, allow him to do a mitzvah.
What's the year of that?
This is the same one, 1968. 68. Okay? So it's been around for 20 years. And give me back to Vov. You're back on Vov there? All right. That's the beginning of that shuvah. There comes the second shuvah here. One written to Gillespie of our faculty. 1970. Where Rabbi Gillespie wrote him a lengthy treatise on why it's brain death is not acceptable. And he said, watch what he's talking about. And no one wants to read a tshuva before they quote the tshuva. It's good to read it before you quote it. They say that we determine life in the brain. And therefore, if the moach does not toil for us, are doing its function, even though he can breathe independently. What's the tshuva referring to? Karen Quinlan, cerebral death, not brain death. Brain death has nothing to do with it. This tshuva is quoted so widely. The tshuva says specifically, I'm dealing with a patient who, af shadayin hu no shame, he can still breathe. That's why I object to the standards that the doctors are trying to introduce. And here, maybe in the question period, Michael Kielsen will be able to tell you of his attendance at conferences. He's been kind enough to share his notes with me. What kind of pressure is on for people who are declared as permanent vegetative state, PVS, who can live for 20 years in that state, how the pressure is on to use them as organ donors. No question, they breathe independently, they just will never recover from this deep coma. And the medical community is pushing to get a law to approve the use of these patients as organ donors. That's what the Shrael was referring to. No matter how badly the brain is damaged, as long as the brain stem hasn't been damaged, then he's entitled to all the protection of society. Or better yet, a society's morality is judged by the degree of care they give to their most helpless members. And the most helpless members of society is a patient who's lying in deep coma, who can only breathe and do nothing else. You move up this one, then comes the next one. Next one that's quoted because it was in 1978, a later one, right? And he writes there, and this was quoted, look, in 1978 he answered it. It's quite true. If you saw that the previous chart, when did transplants come in as for real? 1980 was the first time when transplants began to be treated as therapeutic. 1982 was the first spurt
in the use of transplants. It's only 1988 today. This is how recent all these findings are. By Art Frank in 78, he makes reference to the fact that the Eimhard, the Bukulim painting, that we don't want to discuss it at all, and quotes me as the source for his information that indeed brain death is not acceptable, that the standard that is being demanded by the medical profession is unacceptable to halacha. Again, we are talking about patients who could breathe independently, and therefore the halacha opposed the medical decision to consider imminence of death as tantamount to death. Is there anything to drink there, please? Two more minutes. For Rav Shech to put a cup right here. Okay, let's get the next one. And here comes the only tshuva that my father-in-law has on brain death. There is no other tshuva on brain death except this one that was written to me. In 1976, I posed the question. It was obvious that brain death, now legislation, would be passed. I was then in contact with the President's Commission already. I testified. I'm listed among the consultants on that decision to approve a brain death. And the question there was posed concerning brain death.
Even though he's breathing only very faintly, very lightly, he's still alive, isn't it? Now, therefore the Rambam says, Yishem at Shemin Esalif, Shuzman di Epshal Lichyot Bolo Neshima. You have to wait until you're sure that the apnea has lasted long enough so that he couldn't possibly live after that absence of breathing. And the Shreya told out a figure there of 15 minutes, approximately 15 minutes. The apnea test that's finally decided upon by the medical profession is 10 minutes. And the truth is, you most likely don't need more than 4 minutes or 5 minutes. The Shreya said 15 because I told them 10 was what they were discussing. And since he had a healthy respect for the individual's ability to push things in either direction, that's what made him into a great posik. Therefore, we added a few minutes, like you do for Taste for Shabbos. Right. Therefore, he divides. What do you do? Give the kareiz from him. Check himself. And what do you do? He says, when the machine has to be checked, there the yiv eizah from him yiru sheinu noshin. There's siman amisa sheyishu hazeh vein laharei. No one should question. And that's vaday the definition of misa. What are we talking about here? The classic brain death patient on a respirator, the heart is beating, etc., etc. Then he says, then he mentions all the new facts. Then the time holum shenikra chronically ill patients who are slowly approaching death. Then when they finally stop breathing, you check, etc. What about trauma cases, right? Where you had an accident, a machine, an automobile accident, etc. There he says, what do you do there? You have him on the machine, and then he repeats again. I would also meet him with peers. You can't take it out if his mouth, the respirator, shema, who chai viage over there. Maybe you'll stress it. I will chaposko vilavo. In the old days, this was the time they still, most hospitals had an oxygen tank. Oxygen tank got used up. You had to replace it. So there was a gap. You had to clean the respirator a little, the tubing itself. There. That's why the apnea test came in. I'll show you my discussion with the Shreya on that point too. Shemelo chayt v'yatsu v'nishu v'yenishu v'yenishu v'yenishu. You see that he breathes a little bit, you return it again. This is. And then he repeated the newest facts. And that is like my question, should we not require that we use a blood flow study? And my father-in-law opposed any difficulties. There's no doctors can determine, had great confidence in doctors. They say that all the tests, the Harvard criteria show that he's dead. There's no different than the type of condition determines that someone dies. He says, but if you tell me that it's a good idea, so he went along with me. He said, okay, it's a good idea to show. He was at the Omer Shatik in the Sayyid Shalofim, we don't have a whole liberal, they drink us, they drink us, they drink us,
They can check that the connection to the brain is dead. They call a goof. Shemal yavu zel amol kabolu shem amol shum shaykes by goof. Physiological decapitation. If the blood doesn't reach there, the gam shikvah nit have a mol like gam shehavet kuta losher, and the brain has completely decayed. And kain yeshul lahakmos eglu shav shein amalgish kvah mikrum. Even though he doesn't respond clinically to any neurological testing, nevertheless, it's good to wait until you do this bedika. Then I also mentioned to him that sometimes drug overdose can mimic brain death or hypothermia. He mentions that already too. And here is something that is not well known.
Down a little bit.
This I want you to know I had nothing to do with. This is a letter that I discovered years later when the Shreya, we were printing the Shreya's Shuvis. This was in his file. This was typed, since I don't type. He didn't call on me. He must have done it in his yeshiva secretary. This was written to Herbert J. Miller, who was then involved in 1976, involved in this state attempt to get a legislation passed on brain death. I have reviewed once again all the data relevant to Assembly Bill, a bill in relation to termination of death. And if you see someone translating my father-in-law almost literally, it is my carefully considered opinion that this bill has written and has always been unacceptable. Any bill defining death must contain the following clarifications I wrote in my responsum. The sole criteria of death is the total cessation of spontaneous respiration. If a patient presents a clinical picture of death, no signs of life such as movements or response to stimuli, total cessation of independent respiration is an absolute proof that death has occurred. This interruption must be for a sufficient length of time for resuscitation to be impossible in approximately 50 minutes. If such a clinically dead patient is on a respirator, it is forbidden to drop the respirator when the respirator requires servicing, word for word, the tshuva, right, the services be held while the patient is carefully continuously monitored to take any signs of independent breathing, no matter how feeble. If such breathing motions do not occur, it is certainly that he is dead. If they do occur, the respirator shall be immediately silent. Must emphasize any bill which does not contain these criteria is unacceptable. In the event that these specific requirements will not be incorporated, I strongly endorse and support a religious exemption clause. Which means if they do put this in, I don't need a religious exemption clause. There's no religious issue here. It's a strictly halachic issue. My father-in-law didn't worry about people disagreeing with him in halacha. The halacha is that he's dead. He has no objection to the bill. If you don't put in my halachic requirement, then I will join others in saying that you are violating the standards of our religion, and therefore we want a religious exemption clause. This, if you anyone remembers my Shreya signature, in English, This is his independent answer in English. Now move it this way, and I'll show you when February 15, 1986, this is my way of recording my conversations with my friend Zatzal, I explained to him the apathy test. Okay. And I marked for myself, this is my handwriting, approved non-stress test procedure. Safe to remove ventilator without danger of brain damage for several minutes. Confirm adequate CO2 concentration. Observe any respiratory movements. I find the name. A better test, blood flow study, since no stress at all. That is the halacha. People may disagree in halacha with my shreya, but to pervert my shreya's words and claim that he supports those who oppose brain death is what's called in halachic terminology Megale Ponim Batora Shalok Halacha. There is no justification for that. My Shreya Zatzal was not disturbed when people disagreed with him, and I'm not disturbed when people disagree with him either. I'm just convinced that they're wrong. well, that's the last we had that. Okay. That essentially is the key points of my presentation, except for you have one more slide. Sorry, there should be issues of intellectual integrity. You have that? Is that the one? Test. That's it. Outline note. Should be one more.
Yeah.
No, not an outline. I had on there. So I'm sorry. Yeah, and yes, in the third of the outline. 1, 2, 3. Starting number 7. put that on there. That's all right. That's it. Okay. Now we're just a quick summary, the key points. I entitled this section, Issues in Intellectual Integrity, Confused or Confusing. Whether the face of the person who said this was confused or whether he was willfully confusing, that's for him to worry about. I find this to be untenable within the rules of academic freedom to allow anyone to willfully misquote or to not knowingly try to confuse. It violates Torah principles and even violates secular academic principles. The idea of confusing cerebral death with total cessation of brain function, when my Shmuel Shuvik clearly said, Alpha Pisha, who no shame, can only be looked upon as either willful or such sloppy scholarship is not to be worthy of mention. Second, not to recognize that changing halacha versus responsive halacha is the key to our survival. We don't change halacha, but halacha certainly responds to changing medical facts. The idea that a tshuva was written in 1968 should be cited as absolute halacha for 1988 without recognizing that in that period of time, cardiac transplant went from murder to therapy. The 6-year survival now on cardiac transplant is better than 60%. The 6-year survival. The 4-year survival is 85%. It's almost better than appendectomies. In fact, it's safer to have a heart transplant than to undergo a neurological examination. The not to understand after Dr. Steinberg, a fine Talmud Chacham and a neurologist from Shari Tzedek, wrote to clearly differentiate between angiogram and the technique that I had recommended, the radioisobolus, and still to confuse it in 1988, deserves careful, careful study why. The respirator for a brain dead patient versus a dying lung, that kind of strange comparison, which every doctor can debate out, every child can understand the difference, deserves to be underscored. Again, no one dies when he stops breathing. When he stops breathing, he may die if no one helps him. But stopping to breathe doesn't mean you're dead. When you're dead, you do not breathe. I checked for absence of breathing to prove that the patient has died. It is a test of death that occurred, not the test that the brain has died, the test that the patient has died. The distinction between independent voluntary motion and tremors. Rashi said, "Sheino mezes evolov." Eino mezes does not mean his heart is beating. Eino mezes evolov means there is no movement of his organs. So those organs that are subject to voluntary motion, the fact that there is a heartbeat, the Gemara questions, should I go ad libo or can I stop at chotmo? And Moshe says, don't bother, stop at chotmo, you don't have to worry about anything else. The fact that a tracheotomy or esophageal injury is not synonymous with apnea, with inability to breathe, and therefore the critics have cited the Gemara, if they cut shnei simonim, Omer keeps forgetting the ishti. He says, write a get for my wife, that he can still write a get. Of course, he's a dying patient. The dying patient can write a get for his wife. He can breathe. In fact, maybe if he had a stuffed nose, he breathes better now that he has his trachea cut open. The denial of an open Gemara that physiological data, physiological decapitation is clearly mentioned in the Gemara. In the case of Zikna Shaini, I refer to that as a geriatric bias. The fact that death occurs to an old patient, to an aged patient without the need for an anatomical separation, that is clearly stated in the Gemara. And then the issues of the contrafactual, the term that I copied from one of the critics. He criticized my Shmuel Shuva on prostatectomy by saying it was contrafactual. It means it's a lie. Contrafactual is a lie. It is a question of lying or lack of integrity when you, in 1988, repeat a tshuva that says, well, after all, heart transplant doesn't work. The patient will certainly die within a few weeks. When you have data of 4,000 plus people running around with someone else's heart 2 years after surgery, where you have data that 60% are alive 6 years after surgery, How can you make a contrafactual statement to say that this will lead to the death of the recipient? There is no death of recipient, there is no death of donor. These are the facts, halakhic and scientific. They are one and the same. If I can conclude as I did, as I began in the Torah Mada lecture, this week said, Moshe Rabbeinu saw the burning bush. And he said, Asura no ve'ere. I have to go over and take a look. And God said, he wants to come and understand my natural world. That's my man. I'll give him a Torah as well.
In the interest, may I have your attention, please? In the interest of time and the fact that people's schedules are complex, we will not take any questions at this time. We will break for 5 minutes and at 10 minutes.